Hello, and welcome to Meet a Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 31st, 2004. Today's session number is CAM 2004-05. The speakers for today are Mary Carlson and Dan Spencer. The lesson for today is Bioethics as Vocation, Our Bodies, Our Faith, Paternalism, and Informed Consent. Let's listen in.
Good morning, Miss Mary.
Yeah, good morning, Miss Mary. By the end of the week, we're all sort of buddies, and we thank you all who've stuck with us, and welcome those of you who haven't been before. Say it's another lovely day. It's your last chance to leave and hike. It'll give you 2 minutes to exit. Welcome. Is anybody here for the first time with Dan and me? Oh, good. All right. Please do take the handout that's going to come around shortly and help yourself to any of our other handouts from the earlier part of the week, case studies, other background information that might be useful for you, because we don't want to haul them back down and we'll leave them at the village in the resource room. But
I'm going to hand a couple around here. We probably have enough right now for every other person if you want to be looking on. This one here, we're going to be using a lot of the information from this first one I'm handing out. So if you don't have yours from previous classes on this,
I'm Mary Carlson. I teach at St. Olaf College in social work. I've also worked a lot of years in medical social work contexts, a little bit currently in an emergency room and with hospice.
I'm Dan Spencer. I'm teaching at the University of Montana, previously at Drake University in Des Moines. People keep giving me credit for teaching at Duke University. I wish I could say that was on my resume.
Yay, Montana!
The more modest Drake University, and now happen to be in Montana.
We've taught together a number of times up at Holden. Are glad to be together this time as well. And we would like to take a couple minutes at the end, if we don't get too wrapped up in the cases for today, to just ask for a little feedback. Some evaluative comments is helpful for us. If we get time to do that, we certainly will. What we intend for today, and in a way we look forward to the last class, because the cases we've looked at earlier in the week, from allowing to die to physician-assisted suicide, organ donation, what did we do yesterday, late-term abortion, basically have presumed decision-making capacity or competence on the part of the patient or involved people. We're talking about people who have capacity to make their own decisions and choices. Today's cases we'll go through together, and they deal with some more borderline kinds of situations. Really, who gets to decide, and in what kinds of situations will people be able to make their own decisions? So we're going to talk primarily today about the first four ethical principles, because in issues of paternalism and informed consent, these are the ones that come into play mostly. So we're going to spend a little time going over these primary principles and what they're about, because we haven't gone into lots of detail about them, but they will be illustrated in the cases. And then we have four cases we hope we might get through in small groups, but everybody will do the same case, and then you can take them with you as well. Enough for introductory at the moment? Okay. Keeping in mind that our goal is to provide you with some language to be carefully considering ethical questions in your own personal life, in your professional life, or as you write to policymakers or become policymakers yourselves, whether you're active in your congregation and looking at Lutheran social statements or other similar statements from your church body, or you're in the other realm, as we would say, of policy and politics. Underlying much of bioethics in our society is this notion of respect for persons. Philosophical ethics, it comes through in most of the strands of philosophical ethics, and it's certainly grounded in religious, particularly Christian ethics, so I would say across other religious traditions as well, which is a respect for the dignity and worth of the individual person. That human beings are worthy in and of themselves. They have intrinsic value, which means we should value them in and of themselves as ends and not use them as means to another sort of end. That's the sort of most basic notion of respect for person as human beings. Within that, however, as we've looked at throughout the week, there are major differences. Does respect for person mean that we have respect always for sanctity of life? Some have referred to this as the vitalist position. The body must be saved. It's a temple of God, created by God. We must keep it alive, whatever possible ways we have at our disposal. God has given us brains, we figured out technology, keep people going. So that's about preserving life, basically at all costs. We were just talking about a case that we could have used relative to this in Minneapolis, where a woman said to her husband all through her life, keep me going. Keep me going, whatever it takes. And she kept going on a respirator at Hampton County Medical Center in intensive care for months and months and months. Finally, the hospital took the husband to court to say, this is futile. The Helen Wang, the case, some of you may know, this is futile. It's not helping her. It is harming her. This is not life. That sort of illustrated the keeping her going, sanctity of life position, as compared to quality of life. But when we talk about quality of one's life, who decides what that is? And does respect for persons mean that that person gets to decide, or the person making decisions for that person, which we'll get into with autonomy? Or might somebody else put a judgment on one's quality of life? And when we get into medical futility questions, that is always raised. More to say about that? So within one principle, we can have a dilemma, can't we? Sanctity of life, quality of life. Some would argue that if we don't look at quality of life arguments and say there are things that are worse than living life, I mean, this is the worst way to live, and one of our cases will address this, I don't want to live if this can't happen, that if we force somebody to continue to be kept alive, that is damaging, perhaps, and not respectful for that person. So there are some real dilemmas in there. Okay.
I want to talk just briefly about a couple of the other ones here. Non-maleficence, we've talked about, is particularly coming out of the Hippocratic tradition, Hippocrates, the Greek physician, who lays this as the fundamental grounding for healthcare providers, that it, at very least, do not harm innocent persons. And so non-maleficence, the duty not to harm or not to intentionally harm innocent persons, is a critical one in the grounding for bioethics. And its corollary or complement is beneficence. That is, the flip side is the positive duty to promote the whole well-being of the patients here. But beneficence itself raises all sorts of questions. One of the key ones, or two key ones, is one, who decides what well-being is? Whose perspective? Is this the physician's perspective? Because she or he presumably is the expert or the qualified one in knowing what to, particularly medical well-being or health is. Is it the patient's right to determine whole well-being, what beneficence means in terms of him, his or her own capacity here? And we'll see that this is one of the central issues in the dilemmas we're going to be talking about in terms of paternalism. When we talk about the duty to promote the whole well-being, and particularly the physician's duty to do this, what are the limiting factors that come in on that, and how do we decide that? Part of what makes this, I think, a very interesting case today, or subject today, and Mary will talk a little bit more about this, is over the last 30 to 40 years, our healthcare system in this country has been shifting from one that was strongly based in paternalism and the duty of beneficence. Basically, the doctor knows best. So when you put yourself in a healthcare situation, you entrust yourself to the trained authorities. They know what's best for you and largely make decisions without your input. We've shifted strongly from that into you, as the patient, have the right to make determination for yourself. The doctor's duty is to inform you and make sure you understand what your options are, but you have the right. So we're shifting largely from beneficence-based to autonomy-based. But it's going to raise some very interesting questions in the in-between realms on that. So when we're talking about beneficence, we're talking, again, about the whole well-being, which includes physical, spiritual, mental, emotional well-being. And then the issues about, in the borderline cases, how do we decide this and on what grounds? And I'll let Mary talk a little bit more about I put on here the paternalism, which we're looking at today, primarily involves tensions between the duty to beneficence and the right to autonomy. But autonomy has lots of subsections under it. They're listed fairly carefully in the handout that we gave there, but I'm going to let Mary talk us through that.
I might have blanked out for just a minute, but did you say...
We're still at Hartley.
Just for a minute. It's that getting up early and cleaning the chalet.
No, said Mary sat down and looked at me this morning again and said, "You again?"
We've been joined
at the hip all week here, so...
Did you say beneficence involves as well minimizing harm and maximizing and promoting well-being?
Yes.
Minimizing and maximizing, okay, because those will come into play with our cases as well. Okay, thank you. How many of you have traveled abroad? How many of you have asked anything about the healthcare system elsewhere? Have any of you found in other countries a focus on the rights of the patient to make decisions like we have in the U.S.? Because we're trying to think about if there are any other countries that we're not aware of where the patient's rights movement is as strong as in the U.S. I don't think so. Okay, then I'm going to make a generalization, which is to say, I think we're the only country in the world where patients have the role we do in our own healthcare decisions. Mm-hmm. And we have really pushed for that, along with a number of other kinds of civil rights movements, so women's rights and gay rights, consumers' rights, disability rights, have been very strong since the 60s. And it's very different when you go elsewhere. And I lived a year in London last year, and I intended to study some advanced directives in London and sort of compare living wills, if you will, in Britain and the US. And I started doing the research before I went and found out they don't do them. On occasion they do. Some people are, and there is some case law in Britain where individuals have said ahead of time, here's what I want, here's what I don't want, and that's been tested in their courts. But there's no legislation similar to our Patient Self-Determination Act, passed in 1992, which says every person has the right to put in writing and make choices about one's advanced care, and particularly if we are at the end of our lives or at some point unable to make our own choices, we can put them in writing and others are to follow that. This is unheard of around the world. So that it's a fascinating context, really. So our focus in this country, from the beginning of the country, on rights of people is really, really strong in healthcare, and it comes into play very strongly in bioethics in particular, and in our situations for today, it would be really strong. So autonomy talks about our right to choose, our right to self-determine. The cases for today, however, are gray, because what does it take to self-determine? Usually now, in medical care, most of you by this week are familiar with the concept of informed consent. It really has the realities of this. You must be able, as the patient, to understand what you're being told. That in itself implies some things, doesn't it? That you have the intelligence, the education, and the ability to understand medical terminology, prognosis, diagnosis, and pros and cons of certain kinds of treatment, that you then can say, yes, I want, or no, I don't. So that's a lot in informed consent. To determine whether somebody is able to have informed consent, we do something in the medical field called determining competence, and that is still used a fair amount. But in bioethics, they're trying to be even more clear, because competence is pretty global. And usually when we talk about a competency determination, it is a court process where people are determined whether or not, and Jan can help me with this, working in disabilities, whether or not they can manage their lives. And there are degrees of this with conservatorship and guardianship and so on. But to say somebody is incompetent has a legal ramification and definition. And truly incompetent people with guardians don't have any rights. They can't vote. They can't make decisions on their own about their money, their property, themselves. So that's pretty far out. And we're not talking about those cases today. People, yeah.
If you have a conservator, you can vote.
Right, that's why I said guardian. There are tiers of this, and it does, thank you, it does vary by state, so it gets quite complicated. So I think it's helpful for us not to use terms competent and incompetent when we're talking about healthcare decisions, unless we really mean somebody is incompetent in their in sort of globally. It's much more useful and careful to say, does this person have decision-making or decisional capacity for this decision?
at this point.
And Mary, the other thing that's very helpful about that is think about our own lives. At particular times, we may very well have decision-making capacity, and there'll be other times when I'm suffering trauma, suffering depression, suffering whatever, that simply incapacitates me for that time and that period. So it moves it away from a state of being that's sort of there into, you know, we really recognize a confluence of factors at any particular time influencing this.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. So for having decision-making capacity, three things have to be there and present. One is the capacity to understand diagnosis, prognosis, pros and cons of treatment. Two is the ability, with that information, to decide, to make a decision, yay or nay, about this or that. And three, and very important, is the ability to communicate the decision to others. So if you think about people you've known who have severe stroke and have expressive aphasia, and how long it takes some people to communicate a decision, communicate is important. How do we know what they want? They may have the capacity to understand and to make a decision. Now we have to find out what they want. We have to, for some people, use message boards, little letter boards. We have to ask yes, no questions so they can raise an eyebrow, or squeeze a hand. So communicating the decision is as important in some of these situations as hearing the information and making the decision. So those three steps need to be there for true decisional capacity.
And just one thing again, even when that seems very clear, it can be very difficult to discern. I mentioned before the Terry Schiavo case right now in Florida, dispute between the husband and the biological family of a woman who is in permanent vegetative state, is she?
Right.
Yeah, the family insists that she blinks in an orderly response to her questions. The husband says she does not. The physicians have argued, the physicians for the husband have argued that this is a random state, simply a neurological thing. The family has brought in physicians to say, no, they can detect a pattern in this. So it's all centering about the ability, is she communicating a decision or not? And even there, there's a dispute going about how to interpret that. So sometimes these get very, very complicated in how they play out.
And we could do a whole week again on the layers of sort of cultural issues that involve with this. If we think about the influx of Hmong refugees who are finally getting to arrive in this country, particularly in St. Paul, Minnesota, from the Thailand refugee camps that are being closed, consider what it takes for them to hear information, understand it, make a decision, and communicate it with their own language, and not knowing our medical language, let alone English, and sort of, oh, yeah, it's very complex. Okay, so what happens when we don't have decisional capacity, or it's sort of gray? Then there are two concepts I'll cover, and then we'll get into the cases. And I see we didn't have best interests out there for some reason. Can you imagine? What's with that?
We just don't have anything under surrogacy.
Yeah, well, it's either,
it's best interests or substituted judgment.
Yeah. Did we write either one of those?
Neither
of them.
Okay. They're on your sheets there. So these standards are on your sheets.
So if people cannot make their own decisions, therefore are found to not have decisional capacity for this situation, we have two ethical corollaries that happen. One is the decision maker, whether it's a parent for a minor, it's a brother for a sister, it's partner for a partner, we'll get into who those decision makers might be. Surrogacy means we have one of two ways to do it. Either if I'm deciding for Spence, because he can't, he doesn't have decisional capacity, my job, first of all, is to substitute my judgment for his judgment for mine, is to step into his shoes and say, this is what Spence would want, not what Mary would want if I were Spence, or what Mary would want for Spence. This is what Spence would want. So while he might say, have said to me, you know, don't treat me in this kind of situation, I might say, but I don't want to lose him. I don't want to lose Spence. That's not my business. Substitute a judgment. I'm to do what Spence wanted. Substitute the judgment. If there's no way to know, and in what kind of situation would we not know what Spence would want?
He never told anyone. Talk
about it.
Never told anyone. Didn't talk about it.
Go ahead. Doesn't have a living will.
Yeah, never said anything, hasn't filled anything out. Yep. What if we never knew? What if he has a Down syndrome? And there was no way ever in his life he could have told me that. That's possible, isn't it? Yeah. So there's several situations we could come up with where I'd have no idea. So then what do I do? best interests. Then Mary speaks for what would be the best interest for Spence. Can you see how complex that might be? Mm-hmm. And what layers of intent and motivation and meaning might come in there. So first of all, we try the substitute of judgment. And if there's no way to know, then we substitute best interest standard, the best interest for the patient relative to non-maleficence and beneficence, not harming, minimizing harm, maximizing benefit. So our cases will get us into that.
Let me just toss out one. We are going to look at this case, but just again to show you how complicated sometimes this can be. Now imagine Mary and I are married, right?
Which we aren't. Some of you.
Which we're not. This confusion arises quite a bit. We both have spouses who trust us to be with each other. but imagine now that Mary and I are married. Now Mary has not been baptized, right? I'm a Christian. Mary's not. Mary's been thinking about it. But Mary has an incapacitating accident now where she can't communicate her wishes. So, it's life-threatening. Mary will die. Should I have Mary baptized before she dies? Well, if I were to look at substitute judgment, was she at the point where she really thinks she wanted it and therefore I'm substituting that? Or is this something I really want for her and I'll do that? Okay, hard to know. We can't do that. So then we go to best interest. Isn't it her best interest to be baptized? Well, from my perspective, it clearly is. But what about Mary's perspective? And so sometimes these are things are clear, and sometimes they have to do with medical treatment, sometimes they have to do with other things. But these are the areas of paternalism. I mean, anybody who undergoes infant baptism has been a subject of paternalism. Somebody made a decision, you should be baptized into the Christian faith. And so we do these kinds of things all the time. Now, before we get to the case, one last thing. When we're going to be looking at issues that are borderline on surrogacy, but what are clear cases of surrogacy when someone else must be making the decision? Just categories that are clear cases of surrogacy.
Child.
Children, all right? Up until what age? We have a really interesting society. What age do you become competent to drive in this society? What age you become competent?
Or legally allowed.
No? Legally competent.
Legally allowed.
Yes, legally allowed. I mean, I'm going to talk about legal categories here, but just to point out how confusing this is, because I work with students who are on either side of this board all the time. So, 16 to drive. How about to vote?
18.
How about to drink?
21.
How about to kill other people in war?
18.
So our society has no consensus about what age there is, and that's going to be part of the issue that comes up in here. So children is one. What are other categories?
Child to care for somebody else's children.
Yeah, in terms of babysitting category? Yeah. Ooh. And same thing, how old do you have to be able to legally work? Depends on what kind of work situation. I mean, so we don't have a clear consensus even in legal categories. But children's one case of surrogacy. What are some other clear cut cases?
Alzheimer's,
an end-stage life where the patient is no longer able or the person is no longer able to, good.
Severe profound disability,
right? Has never had the cognitive ability to do that. Severe mental retardation. Pardon?
Bad accident that
incapacitated. Coma, permanent vegetative state, these kinds of things.
And mental illness is an enormously gray and difficult area. A diagnosis of mental illness in and of itself does not imply no decisional capacity. But there are times in some mental illnesses where people clearly aren't capable of deciding for themselves. So some states have special advanced directives for people with mental illness.
Okay.
And so, if you're an offender, you lose that right. If you're an offender, the probation, your PO decides whether you're on medication or not.
For mental illness stuff.
For mental illness.
Psychotropics. No longer doesn't the probation.
And if you don't, you can go back to jail. They'll keep you. Yeah. You can't be out of jail and not on psychotropics if that's part of your probation.
Now, Mary, did one quick, then we'll go to the cases. Did you go over in surrogacy situations?
Well, you weren't listening to me.
What's the order of who
no.
comes in? I can't remember hearing it.
No. This is why we're good together. The question is, in surrogacy situations where somebody else needs to decide, how we decide who decides. That's a favorite phrase. I can't guarantee all 50 states, but in most states there is law, they put in law who is the next of kin to make decisions. And my favorite one when I was in practice was to say to, say, a 45-year-old single guy, something happens to you, who decides?
I say, where are your parents? Well, they're in the nursing home. Do you want them to make decisions for you? Well, they can't. Okay, then we gotta do something. generally speaking, it is your spouse, and then it is
your legal spouse.
Legal spouse. That's right. Then it is adult children. Some state laws put it in order of birth, and some don't. It is adult children. If you're an adult and you don't have spouse or children, it is your parents. So you think about that, you're 60, it's your 90-year-old parents, you know. Beyond that, it gets a little hazier, whether it goes out to siblings and then who else. And some laws just stop basically with the immediate family constellation. Mm-hmm. So it can get dicey when somebody has just a niece who hardly knows her and she lives in another state. Is that niece really the right surrogate? By law, perhaps. By ethics, perhaps not. Maybe it's the best friend next door with whom she's had coffee for 40 years every morning. So some real dicey things about who gets to decide. But in law, with blood and marriage ties, there are in our state some categories. So you might check that out.
Are you going to tell us later how we can help ourselves on that situation?
I should come back next week and do advanced practice. Check in your state about advanced practice and use that term.
Okay.
And while Spence is talking some time, or maybe in our small groups, I'll put up a couple of websites that can be useful.
You can do the guardianship, too.
Yeah, ask about guardianship.
All right, you better get to cases.
Yep.
You want to hand this to the side on?
Yeah.
And we ask you only the one ethical thing. Don't read ahead. Cases in order. They're in order for a particular reason.
And I forgot to put them on back-to-back so we could cut them. They're mixed up, so we cut them messy, you see what I'm saying? So just read here.
I think we've got enough for everybody here. And let's hand some up. If somebody will come over here, Mark, whatever, I'll hand some up to them.
Do you have large printers?
Oh, yes, we do. We have some large printers.
Yeah.
Okay. Just some extras.
Here,
we need
some here.
We really have three large prints. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Do you have an extra large print?
I have one more. Yeah. And do we have some extra copies going around? I messed up over there.
Do you?
Okay.
Extra one.
I think what we'd like to do this time is have we're going to do a little small group thing, right? Okay, groups of 3 to 4. It'd be great if you met somebody new, if you can, but, you know, you don't have to travel across the room.
No.
And would you just read case one? We're all going to do the same case, and we'll try to get through 3 or 4 of them today.
Okay. Yes, I will.
You're really seasoned ethicist now. You know the process. So think about what's ethical here and why.
No, well, I'm thinking the Salem Ghetto. I'm coming over here.
Salem Ghetto?
Well, we're over the same
country. I know, I agree.
So you're afraid to
All right, for the sake of the time, pretend I'm doing announcements. I need your undivided attention. I want to read this together. The tape will pick it up. All right, case number one. Janet and Joseph are practicing Jehovah's Witnesses, a religious group which prohibits the injection of blood into the body. Janet and Joseph refuse to sign a consent for blood infusions before the delivery of her baby. Tests by physicians determine that the newborn infant requires transfusions to prevent retardation and possible death. The parents refuse, citing their religious beliefs. An ethics hearing is conducted by the hospital to decide whether the newborn infant should be given transfusions over the parents' objections. As a result, the hospital petitions the court to name a guardian for the infant who can sign the necessary releases over the strenuous objections of the parents. Should the court name a guardian to allow the transfusions to be administered? Now, we've got the steps spread out we'd like you to think about here that we've been talking about here. First one, what are the main ethical issues? Identify the ethical issues, and is there a conflict or a dilemma? where you see the main ethical dilemma or conflict here. And then what do you see is the set aside any legal knowledge you might have about this, what do you see as the most moral, the ethical response to this situation? And you got about 4 minutes.
Like you said, reason, thoughtful reflection, right? 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we said 3-4 minutes. It probably was.
Is this how fast my ethics committee
is? Yeah, right. They have 8 cases in 5 minutes. Actually, they get very skilled at these, but it doesn't mean that they're ever. Okay, what is the primary conflict here in this case? What is the primary ethical conflict?
And we tend to refer to ethical conflicts or ethical dilemmas as when there's a conflict between two or more of the primary ethical principles involved.
We thought there was a conflict between autonomy and beneficence. Okay.
And how so?
Yeah.
Well,
tell us.
The parents, in this case, are speaking to your unborn child, and they have a desire. And it's difficult to say that, from our perspective, that withholding the treatment would promote the total well-being of this child.
How would the parents argue that they're arguing in the best interest of this child? What might they cite as the best interest of this child?
This is what God has provided for us, and if we are to raise a child with mental retardation, that's what God is wishing for us. If this child dies, that was God's will as well.
Spiritual well-being. And yeah. what would be the problem with going in from the transfusion, according to the parents, for the child?
Totally against their religious beliefs.
That child becomes contaminated, not just physically, but spiritually in terms of their... So they're going to argue that's the best interest. They can't substitute judgment. They don't know what the child would want. So they got to go to best interest, and they're going to argue based on their religious beliefs of best interest.
And we could also add, no medical procedure is without risks. I mean, even a transfusion to an unborn in terms of red, there are lots of tests on the blood supply, blah, 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 but the risk with an invasive procedure that you elect is different from the risk with something where nature is taken.
Very good point, Mark. And the flip side of that is even when there's a medical prognosis, diagnosis that has a high degree of certainty,
right.
It's never 100%.
Right.
So you have situations where, without doing the blood transfusion, the baby would be just fine. It's rare, but you could know that. So good, yes.
My question is, she was saying that the baby would be contaminated if we got the blood. However, could the parents rightly justify it by saying they took all this decision away, it's not our fault, we didn't break the law, so our child had no choice, so wouldn't that then be acceptable to the religious people? I mean,
one could hope it. One could hope that, but there have been situations where a child has been rejected by a religious community once these things have happened. One could hope that they would, say, okay, it was out of our hands, we'll still take and love this child.
Nope.
We can't know that.
Okay. Which is getting into some of the consequences, shorter and longer term, for various actors here and agents. What else might you have gone into with what might happen?
I just wanted to add one thing. My personal experience in this is relevant in terms of consequences. I'm not a Jehovah's Witness, obviously. But when we became pregnant with twins, we were high risk for all kinds of reasons. Our age, blah, 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 blah. So we were encouraged to get all kinds of tests, including amniocentesis, et cetera, on the grounds of risk, probability, blah, blah, blah. Well, we elected for religious reasons, the very first one you gave, except what God gives you, not to have these tests, partly because of some risk to them, but mainly because we're going to assess whatever kind of children we have. Now, I would have hated at that point for someone to say, well, the risks are so high here, could be spina bifida, could be this, could be that, if we do the test now. And I would hate to go down that road, in other words, which I would be going down if I voted, to let the state take over here.
It's very difficult for the healthcare profession, though, to know that there's something so simple as a blood, it might not be simple, but relatively simple as a blood transfusion that could prevent death or prevent retardation. Because I'm a nurse, and I can go on either side of this argument and argue both of them, with my faith beliefs and with that the whole promote the whole well-being. And when you have what it takes, what does this mean?
It means there's a fire alarm going up in another building.
Okay.
We're best to stay here, yeah.
There's no bell. So
no bell here, so we're fine here. In fact, best for the village's sake that we continue on.
To do what we can with what we have to have a healthy, whole individual in our, healthy whole in our our medical eyes.
Wait 1 second, let's hear.
Those are instructions to the first
responder. Yeah, I know what they are, but...
Ignore it! Ignore it!
First responder, if it's not here, it's not sure.
Okay. Anyway, you can argue both sides, because it's difficult for the healthcare folks who know that the chance very likely is that this baby will do very well with one, in this case, fairly simple thing, right?
And the other thing, key thing, we were looking at late-term abortion. Now, yesterday, one key difference here, this baby is outside the womb. This baby is now, at least in the eyes of the law, a legal human being with rights, so forth, on that. And so that's what also comes into the beneficence part. So those physicians, those healthcare providers, have duties to this baby apart from duties to the parents. So how do you, that's one more question, we'll find out how you resolved it.
This is before the baby's born, right?
No. The baby's born.
Oh, it's already born.
The baby's been born. They refuse to sign the consent ahead of time, being Jehovah's Witnesses. We're still allowed to go through the procedure, but the baby has now been born. So outside the womb. So, what did you decide?
The other aspect is just the two ways of people viewing death. For the hospital, death is a failure. For the Jehovah's Witness person, it is just part of the cycle of life. It's not. So, death is the considered the same about death.
And of course, that's one thing if you're a Jehovah's Witness who's 28 years old, deciding it for yourself. You have a baby who has no way of even knowing what its interests are in terms of the religious faith, the other issues here, so being decided for it. So what did you decide?
For the parents.
For the parents.
How many folks think the parents should be able to refuse the medical?
Oh, dear!
How many folks think that the doctor would be right to get a court-appointed guardian to make the decision to do the infusion?
People don't know.
How many didn't decide?
Not sure.
What generally the law does.
It's according to the court, right?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's what I thought about. I mean, in this case, that many times they go with the court with a newborn like this that they can easily treat. And I had easier time with this than I did yesterday with the DNX.
We want to start with one that at least has some clarifying data on this. In my ethics committee, which has faced these kinds of decisions, sorry about the siren, this one be considered at this point kind of a no-brainer, because we've had a couple decades of experience of lawsuits, things like that, and it's almost routine now in this situation that the court will appoint a guardian and the transfusion be performed. But what are some of the longer-term consequences that could be perhaps negative from this?
This child will never be accepted into a very conservative, traditional faith family.
So one would be potential stigma for the child, right?
What else could happen?
Parents could sue.
Parents could sue. In this case, the parents could sue, but the legal precedent is on the side of the healthcare. Right. They would probably lose.
I was a child protective services worker and was faced with this dilemma at least once, maybe twice, and I think that this was in the 70s, and that we called it in the best interest of the child, mm-hmm. and I believe the hospital petitioned the court, and the judge was paid the big bucks. He made a decision on the best interest of the child. The child got a transfusion. But what you have to, something that you have to think about, sometimes parents say, well, if you're going to do that, I don't want this child.
Or, what else might the parents say?
Yeah, so that's a
yeah, exactly.
Right? And then what else might the parents do? If you're going to treat us that way,
go to a different hospital.
Or go to no hospital.
Or go to no hospital, right.
I'll find a hospital where they will treat me well, which is not easy in these kinds of situations. Just stay away.
Yeah.
And then whose interest is...
Because, of course, in addition to the...
Both the mother and the child.
In addition to the ethical mandate, there's also legal liabilities for physicians, for the hospital. If they don't treat and something happens there, you know, and so they're going to always err on the side of treating.
Okay, so what happens if they go ahead and do the treatment and the child still has a problem? You know, that's another alternative. Yes. You know, what happens if, oops. So the parents, will, if they choose to sue at that point, then they have grounds, don't they?
They could have grounds on terms of malpractice kind of stuff, but poorly, I don't think they'd have grounds on the decision to do the treatment, but they could do on the other ones.
I also think this whole notion of there might be a problem, even if it's 90% there might be a problem, opens up a slippery slope I didn't want to go down. I guess we're going down already, but...
Yeah. Well, and Mark, you brought up a really interesting point. At what point does beneficence duties kick in?
Right.
We chose to do it when the baby's already outside the womb, but you brought up the interesting case when there's a pregnancy that's a high risk.
Right.
How much duty is there for, you know, to either allow flash pressure the parents into these tests to diagnose this? And sometimes we do the whole issue of genetic testing, which is just a huge can of worms, when sometimes you know more than you wish you knew in terms of the kind of decisions it forces you to make. But let's move us on to this next case here. We'll see if we can wrap your other conversations into this. Mary, you're going to read them.
We'll do two. Why don't you hand these larger prints?
Yeah, anybody?
For just two. This is two.
Large prints,
case study two. Mary is a 15-year-old girl with diabetes. She takes regular medication to control the diabetes, and her doctors have told her that her condition is stabilized, and she has a high likelihood of leading a normal life well into adulthood. Recently, Mary has decided to become a Christian Scientist and practice Christian Science to respond to her diabetes. Over the objections of her parents, she announces that she will no longer take her medication for the diabetes, but instead will use her Christian Science faith and practices.
Mm.
So again, take 3 minutes or so in your small groups and say, what should be done? How do you think about this?
She's
a
15-year-old.
Let's go for it.
What do you mean it matters? It does matter if they had a good relationship or a bad relationship. They had a good relationship, maybe, you know, in their state. When can you make a decision?
Well, that's what matters.
Yeah.
No 15-year-old has a good enough relationship with their parents.
Well, I mean, it matters in the big picture, perhaps, in the ethical moral reflection, perhaps, but in deciding about who decides, does the relationship with the parents matter?
No.
No.
Go ahead.
I think she should. The parents should see that she goes to a Christian Science practitioner and get the advice of that practitioner. I don't know what the parameters are as far as diabetes is concerned, but it's certainly a disease that you can't pray away. And that practitioner may give her good sound advice that she would then take her insulin.
Doesn't say she takes insulin. Takes medication.
Well,
she
is one. Could be either one.
It
could be the
15. Most juvenile diabetics are on insulin.
Yeah. But now, with 15, increased obesity, there are more and more teenagers who have type 2 diabetes. So it really still could be.
Okay. We don't know how big she is.
She's obese. Maybe the practitioner can say, well, now lose some weight. That way, pray and lose some weight.
Right.
Might give her some good sound.
I think when we were talking, that we, one of the things that we don't know in terms of gathering relevant information is the maturity level of Mary. Is she an impulsive, kind of compulsive, more immature young woman, or is she a mature young woman who's very carefully moved into Christian scientism and things like that?
Yeah, and any of us ever been ourselves or been around a recent religious convert?
In fact, we thought that was the most important word in the case recently. We as her parents would take the position, we can't support you in this decision. We will when you're 18. We want you to live in this religion for 3 years before you make up your mind. Because 15-year-olds, you know, I'll be a vegan this month and next month a Buddhist. And, you know, in other words, they're trying out different things.
As they should be. It's age appropriate to be doing that.
Exactly. I'm not disparaging this. All I'm saying is if she's 3 years a Christian Scientist, well, then we'll support you fully, we here, this group, but not now.
But in the meantime,
how are you
going to
force her?
How can
you force a 15-year-old?
You're going to
sit on her every day and shove the pill down her throat?
We're going to sneak up on her at 6 in the morning and quick give her a shot and make her up for
breakfast. So that would be the best interest, Tammy. It's in your best interest.
Good morning. And sneak insulin into her food every day.
Yeah, that helps. I guess we thought you could try, and it sounds like a lot of this kind of thing has been tried already, but having lived with 3 15-year-olds in my life now, not counting myself, it's hard to tell them anything. And if she has in fact
decided that she wants to do this, we were thinking it might be the best thing to go with her in the hopes that a 15-year-old is going to change, and maybe even 2 days from now, and that the support would win her back faster than the sternness.
Yeah, the paternalism, or maternal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let's go and say, does this 15-year-old, with what we know, which we don't, about her relationship with her parents or how mature she is, we think about decision-making capacity. The question is, does she have the capacity to understand her diagnosis? Probably. Yes. You know. Mm-hmm. Her prognosis?
No. Age 15, they are invincible.
Right. Exactly. Developmentally appropriate to think she'll live forever, and this isn't her issue. So the prognosis, the pros and cons, difficult to understand whether she could really get that and make a decision based on it and then say. So you might have some argument for paternalism in this case to try to go to court and force her. But then one says the moral, I mean, how do you do that? You can't put her in a hospital 24 hours and you can't sneak up on her, you know. But the moral question might instead be to surround her with love, perhaps in your neighborhood, your own church that you've been part of perhaps before she went on to Christian Science. Engage the Christian Science practitioners to surround her and support her and help her think about the pros and cons of various things she's doing, and maybe hope, as you say, she lives long enough to get to 17 or 18 to then let her go. Or to not be quite as invincible. Well, that goes right into 25 by studies. That we're invincible.
Deprogrammers.
I need a quick moment with Biden. What was it?
Yeah.
5 minutes. Should we just go into We would love to do more cases, so we keep talking about this, but we need to respect the 10 o'clock time limit on here, and we would really appreciate getting some feedback from you, those of you who've been here today and throughout the week at different times, about what parts have worked well, what parts could we be doing differently. We've done several different new time issues and cases this week, been trying them out and so forth. But if you can give us any feedback, just about the series for us and for how to do this kind of series at Holden, what's been helpful, what could be done differently, that'd be great.
Things I found really helpful were having your postings up there for reference. It helps people who have missed a session get into the flow very quickly, and it helps me when I come in and I go, oh yeah, okay, that's what they talked about, because I tend to have Teflon-coated brain cells sometimes.
So those of you who were especially weren't at the first session where we went through this fairly carefully but joined later, did it feel like you could pick up and join in the conversation without being too handicapped?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Would you please use all dark markers, though?
Yep.
Because if you're not sitting right in front.
And we have gone away from the red and green middle of the week. We got two people who said, please, don't even use it. And in fact, I told them to quit ordering the fancy ones, hardly, for the teachers. Maybe the kids need them, but I said order lots of black and even blue.
Yeah.
But really the black.
That's right. Important.
That's really awesome.
Yeah. It could be a longer class. Yeah. Although you've done, with the time you've had, you've done great, but an hour and a half or 2 hours would be just smashing.
If Holden could arrange it, because Holden has a fairly tightly scheduled, but if they could arrange an hour and a half or even an hour and 15 minute slot, would this be the kind of thing that would be helping? Would it detract too much from the rest of the kinds of things you're trying to do while you're at Holden?
No, flexibility in scheduling, and like if it was at
afternoon.
Well, or even
8:45 to 5 is a possibility.
Yeah, okay. Or you know, there's that whole thing of with their flexibility about having something that competes with Bible study and people's willingness to skip coffee hour or delay their coffee hour, miss out on treats or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that doing more than an hour is necessary because of your ability to facilitate this hour. You didn't let us digress, and you kept us very, very focused. And I think you made your point in an hour.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think so too.
I thought the handouts were helpful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Take those home, and if we're ever faced with making some ethical decisions, we can use the framework that kind of a model to use.
We have more handouts from previous sessions up here. People didn't get them. That was a place to hold and really helped us out because we've been, it's always that fine line between how much paper you use versus getting information out. But part of what holding is trying to do is to get us to be able to take these things back to our home situations. And so we thought the handouts would be helpful.
And if you lose them or can't find them once you get back, you could sure email me, or I don't have his in my head, so you could put that down.
Yeah.
Remind me to say one thing about advanced directives after people said.
I missed only one of your sessions. Did you give books that we might read that have cases that go from beginning to end to understand a whole process? Because sometimes, you know, we do the case. I understand all the concepts. It would be really interesting to see how those concepts are put to a page that actually went around. And I would love references to it on my own.
I couldn't find about a case study source.
There are some good ones there, but I don't have my top line here. Yeah.
Okay, what is the website, the www?
Well, let me say, advanced directives, we have a national law that says we all have the right to put in writing what we think we might want relative to a number of things at the end of our lives. State law varies, however, what it looks like, what it can cover, whether you have to be 6 months away from death, and a bunch of stuff. Fivewishes.org is sort of a national template of an advanced directive that works in most states, if not all states, as a real basic fundamental. But I encourage anybody who spends any significant time in any state, and that means snowbirds, do it in Arizona and Minnesota. Because those laws are different and they don't necessarily respect each other's advanced directives, but that you look at in your own state law and you just search advanced directive and Iowa and see what comes up, because virtually every state has now put into law what's possible to do, the requirements for when it's put into effect, and whether it's a combined durable power of attorney for health care and your wishes, or if you just appoint somebody to make decisions for you, or all of those things. Very complicated, but if you want to put some wishes in writing, do that. Let me also just say one final thing about it. That is not the end of what you should or ought do. That is the beginning of a conversation you have with the loved ones around you who will be the ones at your bedside looking the medical system in the face and is trying to substitute judgment or do best interest. So start the conversation with that piece of paper right in front of you, and then keep having it, because your life will change and your issues will change and your beliefs might be tested as things advance. And good luck. God bless. Thanks for sitting down.